From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This convention week, it was hard to tell what was the greater subject of revelation, the Democratic nominees or the tortured psyches of the media. The lamentations started last Saturday when the Associated Press ran a piece about the press corps complaining about the lack of porta-johns. Then followed reports about the cramped working conditions and the elaborate pass system. And throughout, the media noted with stoic distaste that there would surely be no news at this event, but they, the brave, the true, the many, would soldier on and flood the zone, even if the networks would hardly cover it.
But cover it they did. If by it you mean everything but what the long line of speakers actually said from the podium. On TV, at least, there was but scarce commentary on the substance of the speeches. Unlike much of the public, the jaded reporters had heard it all before, and it bored them. What fascinated them were the big questions of these nervous times. They were ensnared by imponderables like these.
How would Teresa Hines Carey handle the role as First Lady? Would she be more reserved like Laura Bush or more outspoken like Hillary Clinton?
I think more like Hillary.
Should this picture,
Carey in a laboratory jumpsuit,
be compared to this one?
Dukakis in a helmet.
Many people are asking that question today.
I don't think so.
Ron Reagan. Wait a minute, isn't he a Republican?
I don't know.
I gotta tell you, Steve, I watched a feed yesterday when Howard Dean was speaking in Florida, and he is still an angry man. Do you think that that same kind of Bush-hating anger could deflate the Kerry campaign the very same way it destroyed Howard Dean's?
Yes.
No.
Maybe. Glad we could clear that up. If only we'd been there, we could have made a difference.
Mike Pesca of NPR's Day to Day was, so we called him up on the last day of the convention. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Brooke.
So what's with the irrelevant questions? Where do they come from?
Desperation. Sheer desperate flop sweat. I can't totally blame the media, because when the politicians, when the parties create the convention, what they're trying to do is pre-chew the news and then regurgitate it right back into the mouths of the viewers via the media. And, you know, the media has to do something to stop that process. So what they try to do is they try to create some conflict and drama.
Some of these pressing questions seem to be plucked directly from the talking points of the Republican National Committee.
Well, there are these little shadow delegations of the opposition party, and they're cranking out press releases all the time. I mean, the GOP.com website is cranking out a press release a day. Often, they just don't get picked up. During the convention, I've been to that site every day. I've been to the room where they craft the message. And I have to say, I've seen somewhere in legitimate media almost every one of those press releases represented. You know that the people asking the questions wouldn't have had the idea without it being planted in their minds. But, you know, the Democrats are going to do the exact same thing.
Yeah. And I think one of the clearest examples probably is the likening of Kerry in his science suit with Dukakis in a tank, which, you know, they really have nothing to do with each other.
You're right. Dukakis in a tank went right to an issue that was seen as a deficiency, military. No one sees John Kerry's stance on science or space funding as a deficiency. He probably knows a lot about it, as a matter of fact. You know, so it's just like, hey, silly outfit, silly outfit. But that got more play than a number of silly outfits that the man's worn. But it's during the convention. And, you know, one paper, the New York Times, has 100 reporters here. Cable networks have more than that many people here. Most of the major papers in America have entire pullout sections. So some of the standards for what would pass muster as newsworthy get lowered as the amount of actual information doesn't fill those pages.
Now, Mike, you say that one thing reporters don't want to do is regurgitate the speeches. But what happens when the speakers themselves defy expectation, like Al Sharpton did when he delivered his speech? The reporters didn't even seem to be listening, only looking at their watches.
Al Sharpton was supposed to speak for 6 minutes. He wound up speaking for about 20 minutes, Judy.
He goes on and on and on, and you just got to ask, but what did Al say?
We got an advanced text of his speech, and it wasn't very much like what he delivered.
Well, it was kind of like the outliner. And in fact, the person who is now going to rush to the Mailox counter is the teleprompter operator who was flipping the teleprompter. We could see this in the hall back and forth, desperately trying to figure out where Reverend Sharpton was going next.
There should have been a little more attention to the content of a lot of the speeches rather than just seeing it purely as performance. So ironically, we talk about all these extra sections that the newspapers have or cable just going wall to wall with coverage, and there's a lot of stuff that needs to be filled. But it seems like the last thing that they're filling with, and there's a lot of good color stories, which I enjoy, and there's a lot of gossip, which is, you know, legitimate enough for this week. But there's not a lot of analysis of the policies that the speeches are talking about. Let me give you an example.
Mm-hmm.
Barack Obama gave the keynote address on Tuesday. One of the standout lines of the convention was when he said, "We pray to a mighty God in the blue states, and in the red states, they don't like federal agents poking around their library records." And people talked about the performance there and what a star Barack Obama is. But, you know, let's take the second part of that statement, poking around their library records. There's actually a debate there. The Attorney General, John Ashcroft, denied that they ever actually used the Patriot Act in libraries. The ACLU and other civil liberties groups filed Freedom of Information requests to see if they did look into libraries. But that's real policy. And, you know, if you have so many pages to fill, I'd have liked a story on that.
It really seems, then, that while the reporters are complaining bitterly about no news at the convention, they weren't really covering the news that they could have, the news that was actually there. Don't you think this points out a fundamental problem with the political media and perhaps with the media in general, that they just don't seem to understand what it is the public wants?
How people use the convention is to get their only taste of a candidate at length, not buffeted by people telling you what the candidate's going to say and not cut down to a 15-second soundbite, and that's being generous. I mean, you never see, through the 18-month political process, you never see a candidate just talking at length. That just doesn't happen. And the one time it should happen is during a convention. And as the convention gets played on networks less and less.
Only an hour a night for three nights.
And of course, fewer people learn about what they say they want to learn about, which is what all the candidates stand for.
So is that trend likely to continue, or can the networks be persuaded to expand the coverage out of a sense of public service?
Pollsters are telling us that we're going to see higher voter turnout, which is a reverse of a four-term trend. Turnout spiked a little bit in 1992. But in general, the long timeline is that it's going down. People say it'll go up. Now, maybe the networks will be able to turn around and say, see, we did less convention coverage ever, and there still was high voter turnout.
Okay. Mike, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Mike Pesca reports for NPR's Day to Day.
Since we had appointed Mike our on-site media critic, we decided to ask a mere toiler in the convention orchard, Brian Lehrer, host of WNYC's Brian Lehrer Show and former host of On the Media, how he negotiated the pitfalls of reporting from the convention floor. Brian, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Bob. It's always great to be on OTM.
So what's the experience there for one of 15,000 representatives of the media?
I feel like such an insignificant flea. If I ever thought that there was something unique and individual about what I did, now I know better.
That's ridiculous, Brian. You're not an insignificant flea. You're a very significant flea.
Well, the approach that I try to take is to just pluck delegates, big-name politicians, journalists from the floor, from the hallways, bring them over to my little table with the microphones, and have discussions about the issues. We can talk about health care. We can talk about the items in the platform on Iraq. We can talk about what kind of foreign policy he would have. We can talk about what's right or wrong about education, Bush style, any of those things.
Ah, the substance angle. How counterintuitive.
Well, this is one of the great opportunities that much of the local media from around the country that is here has this week. And I think a lot of local media have been seizing on this better than the major networks who have access to, you know, national politicians all the time. We've had, as a New York radio station, Senator Robert Byrd from West Virginia, who would be tough for us to get normally, Senator Saxby Chambliss from Georgia. As a Georgia Republican, he'd probably be reluctant to come on New York public radio. So for politics junkies on our crew, including myself, and for many in our listening audience, it's been a treat for that reason.
You know the story about the blind man and the elephant. One feels the trunk, one feels the tail, one feels the ears, and they have a very different view of the elephant. the way media coverage is so sliced and diced and presented according to the sensibilities of individual channels, like Fox versus C-SPAN, just for example, do you think your listeners are witnessing a very different convention than those who are watching Fox News Channel or the hour that's devoted to the convention by the three major networks?
No doubt. And that's the nature of our media today, isn't it? I've been listening to some of the right-wing talk radio channels here in Boston, the local ones, and to hear them, you would think this convention was primarily about Theresa Heinz Kerry saying, shove it, and Barack Obama, good black man, Al Sharpton, bad black man.
Criticism of this convention, and I guess all other modern political conventions, is that they are, in effect, four-day-long commercials for whatever party happens to be hosting it. Do you find yourself becoming petulant or particularly confrontational with Democrats so as not to appear to be like a de facto PR man for the Democratic Party?
You know, it's a good question because on the one hand, you know it's a Democratic convention and they're here to get the message out and you want to give them a reasonable opportunity to get their message out. But at the same time, the journalistic instincts kick in and, you know, you want to counter every message that they put out there with, but wait, the other side would say, which isn't always the most interesting conversation to have. So it's a delicate line to walk.
Let me ask you one other thing. As you look around the convention floor, something like 2,000 of the 5,000 actual delegates are minorities. And as you look around the assembled press, overwhelmingly white. Is there a disconnect there?
The difference is really striking. There's no way to nuance it. There's no way to finesse it. And we shouldn't. I think there's a little case of news media heal thyself here when you look at the fact that at least the Democratic Party, and it'll be interesting to see the diversity or lack thereof, we'll find out at the Republican convention, it is so different from what we're seeing in media land here that I would hope news executives would be kind of embarrassed about it, to tell you the truth, and redouble their efforts to make their staffs diverse.
Brian, it's a pleasure as always.
Thanks a lot.
Brian Lehrer is the host of The Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC and former host of this very program.
Coming up, Bob Edwards returns to radio for a price. And if you still can't get enough campaign excitement, have we got a show for you.
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This weekend, the Showtime cable network kicks off a 10-episode series that aims to select a so-called people's candidate. The contest winner will claim $200,000 in cash and a national platform from which producers say the victor could mount an actual write-in campaign for president. New Hampshire Public Radio's Josh Rogers picks up the story for On the Media in Keene, New Hampshire, where part of the American candidate was taped earlier this summer.
Strollers under the elms on Keene's main drag witnessed a tableau long familiar to most Granite Staters, a presidential hopeful on the make.
Every year, you guys are the beginning of a broken system. We have got an opportunity to change the country with what we're doing here.
The man with the bullhorn is Bob Vanek. The 42-year-old Californian was one of nine contestants to descend on New Hampshire to compete for the title of American candidate. They can't call themselves presidential candidates because of federal election laws. From his dark suit and red tie to his sober comb-over and permagrin, Vanek looked every inch the real-life politician. But in his parting remark before climbing on an AirSat's campaign bus, Vanek indicated that for him, the medium is indeed the message.
How about non-verbose 20-minute speeches from politicians? 4-minute speeches because it's on television. 4-minute speeches. Vote Bob.
This is a show that absolutely explores the blurry line between politics and entertainment.
R.J. Cutler is one of the American Candidate's executive producers.
This line has been blurring probably since Thomas Jefferson and John Adams ran against each other, and the equivalent of the tabloids, the rags, blurred the line. Certainly in the television age, the blurry line has grown.
Cutler also produced the political documentaries The War Room and The Perfect Candidate. Citing a desire to maintain suspense for his new venture, Cutler was tight-lipped about exactly what American Candidate viewers can expect, but he did confirm a few basics. American Candidate contestants will travel the country and face a series of challenges designed to replicate life on the campaign trail. But unlike real candidates, they don't do fundraising. They also face elimination at each stop based on an American Idol-style telephone vote. In the first episode, hopefuls declared their candidacies in their hometowns. In the second, taped here in New Hampshire, they were competing in a mock political rally. R.J. Cutler says about 1,500 people applied to be on the show, and that producers made their choices with one eye on diverse backgrounds and beliefs, and the other focused squarely on the future of the American Republic itself.
This group represents a strong group of leaders in this country, and it's the goal of the show is to provide a platform for people of vision, passion, and talent. I expect them to go home and, you know, run for city council or mayor or congressman and go from there, and we'll see what happens.
Several of the American candidates have real-life political experience. Keith Boykins once served as a special assistant to Bill Clinton.
Any baby in New Hampshire, every hand, anybody possible, will be happy to contact them and get them to support us.
Greeting supporters, Boykins displayed an on-the-stump MO that would have done his former boss proud. The American Candidate cast also features 27-year-old Malia Lazu, a political organizer whose resume includes a successful redistricting lawsuit against the Massachusetts legislature. After tearfully flashing her tongue ring for a clutch of onlookers, Lazu said furthering debate on issues ignored by real politicians justifies the show.
Really, I'm just trying to do politics differently. You know, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over and expecting a different result. And I can tell you right now, the people who are part of the show are talking about different things.
And some of those different things include expanded rights for animals, drug decriminalization, federally funded kindergarten through college education, legalized gay marriage, and the abolishment of the IRS. If the hyperbole of the show's host, daytime TV veteran Montel Williams, is anything to go by, the revolution just might be televised.
This is a wonderful opportunity for you to show the rest of the nation that we are tired of just a two-party system. It's time to hear the voices of the people. And through something like television, we're going to change the way America thinks about the election process. I guarantee it, and we're starting right here in Keene.
Can I get anybody any signs?
As volunteers at the mock political rally hand out American Candidate signs and special effects technicians load the confetti cannons, Joe Trippi holds forth on the state of the American polity.
We're now in the age of empowerment. I don't believe we're in the information age. I think we're in the age of empowerment.
Trippi was architect of former Democratic presidential hopeful Howard Dean's internet-driven campaign. Trippi is here to watch the American candidates in action. A consultation with him is the prize for the winner of the day's challenge. In between bites of an organic sausage dog, Trippi asserted that reality television is one more arrow in the quiver of those who want to remake American politics.
The internet and the grassroots organizing out there is empowering people from the bottom to actually make a difference in this country like they haven't been able to make since like the 60s. And I think the American Candidate, Dean campaign, there's all kinds of grassroots activity this year that I think really is going to bubble up and make our democracy stronger.
And Trippi is apparently not the only political pro helping the American Candidate reality television show. Executive producer Cutler claims viewers can expect cameos from a slate of celebrity politicos.
Again, I don't want to give away format, but Ed Rollins will be here. Frank Luntz has been involved in the design. He was just here the other day. Joe Lockhart. So there are a lot of exciting people who are involved.
The show's board of advisors lists such names as Kay Maxwell, national president of the League of Women Voters, Norm Ornstein of the American Enterprise Institute, and Professor Henry Louis Gates of Harvard University. Also listed is former Democratic presidential candidate, former U.S. Senator, and 9/11 Commission member Bob Kerry.
I just said I'd be willing to be on their little advisory board, and thus far, They've not sought, nor have I volunteered to give them any advice. And maybe when I see the production, I'm going to say, Jesus, this is awful. At the moment, I don't have any basis to either praise it or criticize it.
This man said he'll hold this one.
Back at the rally in Keene, local civic booster Nancy Sporberg said she hopes for the best and wants Keene to look good on TV, but doubts viewers will think the show is part of a genuine political process.
I guess I have some concerns about it because we don't know a lot about how the candidates were chosen. So my guess is that a producer chose the candidates, and I'm not sure that, you know, if you look at this as being reality, that I'd want a producer choosing my next president.
Standing next to the band she brought in from Vermont, Jean Nelson concludes the American candidate is in keeping with the American way.
I did hear some people saying that this is poor timing for something like this with the elections coming up and so forth. But again, I mean, doesn't everybody try and capitalize on what's going on in reality? It's something like this, which is maybe pseudo-entertainment, capitalizing on a political year. We all do that.
Political opportunism is everywhere here. Sign-waving supporters for George W. Bush and John Kerry have glommed onto the event, as have a handful of New Hampshire politicians. McKim Mitchell, a local Democratic candidate for the state Senate, worked the crowd, and as it turns out, Mitchell becomes a major actor in the collision between the play of reality and the reality play of the show. He's a real candidate running for an actual political office who endorses a fake candidate on a reality show. At the show's mock rally, Mitchell runs into a board member of the Victory Fund, a real-life National Gay and Lesbian Political Action Committee that's just endorsed his actual bid for office. The board member, who has an authentic tie to the pretend politics of the reality show, is none other than Chrissy Gephardt, daughter of Dick.
Hey,
Chrissy.
How are you? Nice to see you again.
Good to see you again.
This is John True.
I'm John True.
McKim, please meet you.
Okay.
Chrissy Gephardt's presence in Keene was something of a mystery, and it even spawned a mock political controversy. Gephardt had earlier officially declared her American candidate candidacy. But when asked what she was doing at the show's taping, Gephardt had no comment.
No comment. I really can't answer any questions, sorry.
Producers were also mum. Rumors, however, made their way through the crowd and remained thick on the internet. A common theory holds that producers pulled Gephardt out of the lineup, but might, audience willing, reintroduce her for the show's finale.
Gephardt! What are you afraid of? Let Chrissy speak! Let Chrissy Gephardt speak! She's right here!
The American candidate is scheduled to begin airing on the Showtime cable network on August 1st. For On the Media, I'm Josh Rogers in Keene, New Hampshire.
For those who miss the sonorous tones of Bob Edwards in the morning, despair no more. Starting October 4th, you can tune him in again for a mere $9.99 a month, plus $99 for an XM satellite radio receiver on XM 133, XM's new public radio channel. You'll also find PRI's This American Life, What Do You Know?, Studio 360, produced here at WNYC, American Public Media's As It Happens, and American Mavericks, WBUR's On Point, and a host of other shows that public radio listeners can also find for free on the internet, if not in their own hometown station. But if you want Bob Edwards, well now, that's going to cost you.
Of course, it isn't the first time public radio has been on satellite radio. For some time now, NPR has been feeding a slate of programs on two channels of XM's competitor, Sirius. PRI programs one channel on Sirius, and together they feed such programs as Talk of the Nation, Marketplace, and The World. But NPR has stopped short of offering its flagship shows, Morning Edition and All Things Considered, for fear of siphoning off the audience and revenue of its member stations. So what does it mean that Bob Edwards, who defined the sound of Morning Edition for a quarter century, will compete against the stations that once depended on him?
First, we'll ask what it means to XM. Chance Patterson is XM's spokesman. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Now, Morning Edition, Bob's old gig, was a mixture of pieces and interviews. How will this show compare with that? You won't have NPR's news division behind it.
Well, Bob has a lot of discretion on what he wants to do with this show, but in general, he's indicated to us that many of the interviews that he's done in the past have been cut and end up being 5 to 7 minute pieces. Here, he will be able to have these folks of interest on the air with him as long as they're interesting. And so it'll be sort of loose. He can dictate what he wants to do on any given day and kind of drive the creative process from there.
Did you find that your competitor Sirius is doing well with its public radio offerings? And is that what gave you the thought?
We've always had an interest in public radio, period. I mean, the fact that Sirius does not carry Morning Edition or All Things Considered and some of the other so-called premier programs of NPR, you know, it's in some ways not what people really view as NPR without those shows available. And that was one of the reasons why we didn't pursue those, you know, at the time they were available. So we've taken a different approach. We have recruited who we consider to be the voice of public radio, Bob Edwards. And this is really our first foray into making talk programming and news programming here in-house. So, you know, you react to what your customers want, and certainly public radio is something they've desired.
Is this the first time a big radio star has moved exclusively to XM?
I think so. There is a meaningful milestone here, and it's probably a first in this industry. So we do treat it as a big win. I mean, we are just thrilled to have Bob, and we're thrilled to launch this channel.
You know, there's been some rumor about Howard Stern possibly getting sick of all the FCC fines, moving away from his syndicators onto XM. That would probably just do it for you guys, wouldn't it?
Well, Howard is obviously similar to Bob. He is a hugely successful radio person, and he has a major following, but he's under contract with Viacom, and that contract runs until late next year. Would we be excited about having Howard Stern on XM? Sure. But, you know, that's not happening today.
Well, I want to thank you for the interview, not least because I've waited all my life in public radio for somebody to say Bob Edwards is similar to Howard Stern.
I don't know if I said that exactly, but I think you got the point.
Chance Patterson is a spokesman for XM Satellite Radio. Now we turn to Carol Pearson, who is president of the National Federation of Community Broadcasters, which represents many small and some large locally based public radio stations. Welcome to the show, Carol.
Thank you.
Could this, in a sense, signal the beginning of the end of public radio? I mean, it was created as an alternative to the commercially funded fare on the rest of the dial made possible by the listeners. But satellite radio is going to offer much the same thing and more, and it comes in higher fidelity and it doesn't fade out when you drive outside of the listening area.
Well, I don't think so, because I think there is a huge amount of interest on the part of the listeners for local content. And these national services are not going to provide that local content.
But local content can cost a lot of money to produce, and it may be some time before a lot of those stations can provide really effective local programming. In the meantime, do you think public radio on satellite radio could hurt them?
You know, I really don't think so. I mean, you can do local content without, you know, a major investment. And I think that we're still in a period of time where expanded exposure to public radio will increase listening to public radio on the local stations, on satellite, on the internet. I think there is still a great potential growth for public radio. And it's why I think it's a mistake for stations to be stopping NPR from putting some of the best programs on the satellite.
So you're saying the important thing is to get the brand of public radio out there, even if you have to put it on pay radio to do it.
It will bring people to the local stations, ultimately. Now, it's interesting that XM is clearly using public radio as the brand for this channel, which is, I think, a sign of how successful public radio is these days. But it also seems to me that in some ways, public radio is losing control over that brand, because somebody who isn't public radio and that isn't responsible to public radio is producing it.
Does NPR feel the hot breath of XM on its tail?
Well, I can't really speak for NPR.
Ought it feel the hot breath of XM on its tail?
Well, I think that certainly it's competition, for listening time, and we know that the amount of time that people listen determines a lot whether they feel like a station is important enough to give money to it. On the other hand, I think that listeners often don't differentiate between whether they're listening to public radio on one particular station or another to the degree that we at the station level do. And so I think having more options out there can be an advantage.
I'm thinking about the PBS analogy. PBS used to offer something that you couldn't get elsewhere in television. Science shows, for instance. Mm-hmm. Then you got the Discovery Channel. Historical programs. Then you got the History Channel. British costume dramas. Then you got A&E and BBC America. Suddenly, with the exception of perhaps Sesame Street, there wasn't anything special that PBS provided. Couldn't public radio be weakened the same way?
Well, I think that's possible, and there's definitely many stations are very concerned about it, particularly because XM really is developing this and controlling it themselves, whereas the channels on Sirius are programmed and controlled by National Public Radio and by Public Radio International. And I think if you look at the cable analogy, if PBS had developed their own channels with their own content, that they would have had more power in that arena and more of an ability to compete.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Carol Pearson is the president of the National Federation of Community Broadcasters. Full disclosure, our producing station, WNYC, is an active participant in public radio programming on both Sirius and XM satellite radio. Coming up, an unfunny joke on the French media, Baghdad reconstruction reality TV style, and the Islamic sense of humor.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this and other NPR member stations and the Kresge Foundation, building the capacity of non-profit organizations through challenge grants since 1924, on the web at kresge.org. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in individuals, their families and their communities, on the web at www.wkkf.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and healthcare of all Americans, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Here's a story for our troubled times. A gang of Africans and Arabs attack and rob a young woman on a train outside Paris, insult her, draw swastikas on her stomach, and overturn her baby carriage. None of the passengers come to her rescue or call the police. The woman went to the French police 2 weeks ago with these allegations, and the public and politicians were horrified. It was the big story on French radio, TV, and in the newspapers. There's only one problem. The anti-Semitic crime didn't happen. Within days, the woman admitted fabricating the story, and everyone backtracked. But the damage was done, especially to the credibility of French media. Independent producer Thomas Marzal reports from Paris.
Within 2.5 hours of the first report of the alleged attack, the French Interior Ministry and President Jacques Chirac had condemned it as hideous and shameful.
Madame, Monsieur, bonsoir. Premier titre de ce journal qui suscite unanimement la révolte, l'effroi.
The affair topped all evening news shows. The dailies ran front-page headlines such as "Vile and Stupid" and "The Train of Hate." Everyone based their reports on the allegations of one woman and the responses from the Interior Ministry and Chirac's Élysée Palace. Sophie Roquel, deputy editor of news for the conservative Le Figaro, defends her paper's coverage.
We were careful. The story said it was her version of the facts. We really insisted on that. But it's the problem when you know, it's July, there's no other big news. If the Élysée plus the Interior Ministry, reacted so big, so for us, that Sunday, it was a big story, I mean, for the newspaper. It gives a lot of credibility to a story.
You have to imagine this kind of climate in France, that when such a story happens, immediately you have to take a position.
Bertrand Pecary is the head of the Paris-based World Editors Forum, a resource center for newspaper editors.
If you don't take a position, you are considered antisemite. It's impossible for ministers, for political leaders, not to immediately take a microphone and saying it's horrible.
The editor-in-chief of the left-wing Libération is Antoine de Godemar. He thinks the media joined with the politicians in the rush to react.
As soon as we hear about a story about, like this, we are conditioned to react immediately. And I think it is very dangerous because we lose our critical spirit. And when you are a journalist, it's the first thing to do, to not to believe immediately what is happening, but to ask questions, to verify. And so it was a hard mistake, but I am not sure that it will not happen again.
Libération, Le Figaro, and every other daily gave as much prominence to the affair when it fell apart. Libération went further. It disclosed in detail how it dealt with the story the day after it broke. It also immediately apologized to its readers and to the Arabs and Africans falsely accused of committing the attack. The last time the paper ran a prominent apology was 4 years ago, then for a page one picture with a wrong caption. In a commentary for Libération, media critic Daniel Schneiderman wrote that people were horrified and fascinated at the same time. He likened the affair to a wolf whose appetite is insatiable.
Everyone is scared of the wolf because it's hungry. But I wonder whether we, French citizens, aren't hungry ourselves, hungry for the wolf. It's as if we need an enemy. It's as if we're hungry for events like this, where we hastily believed the hellish vision of what the young woman said had happened.
Picari lauds the press for frankly admitting its rush to judgment. But he says French media need an independent watchdog. In Great Britain, the Press Complaints Commission can censure the print media for false reporting and bases the decisions on an ethics code the newspapers themselves drew up.
The movement of watchdogs is typically Anglo-Saxon. It's a very good thing that citizens, readers, academics decide to watch the media. The media watch the reality, and somebody has to watch the media. So it's a very simple movement, and I hope we will have the same movement here in continental Europe.
Schneiderman advocates a more American approach.
Perhaps one day we'll no longer fall into such traps. But how? The media have to question themselves. Look at how they work, like the New York Times did concerning the war in Iraq. The lesson is, the media have to investigate themselves more and more.
This week, a court handed the woman who fabricated the whole affair a suspended sentence, and she was ordered to undergo counseling. French media critics might counsel their media to see an analyst as well. For On the Media, I'm Thomas Martzall in Paris.
You've seen those home makeover shows. A crew shows up and some lucky stiff gets to see his house redone by pros. But what if the home isn't in Tarzana or Pottstown or West Des Moines, but in Baghdad? There is such a TV program in Iraqi reality series called Labor and Materials. Each episode, the show visits a neighborhood to refurbish a home destroyed by the war. Journalist Anya Sazadlo reported on the show for the Christian Science Monitor, and she joins me from Baghdad. Anya, welcome to On the Media.
Thanks for having me.
Producing a home makeover show in a country still being rocked by rocket attacks and suicide bombs can't be very simple. I mean, there's still battles going on in some of these neighborhoods.
Yes, and in fact, the day that I went with the crew, they had gone to a neighborhood called Adamia, which is very much a neighborhood in conflict still. The night before we went, there had been a pretty major battle in the neighborhood. In fact, one of the new houses, new windows, had been blown out in this battle. And as we were leaving, a bomb went off in a public square very close to the house. So it was kind of a graphic illustration of the fact that for most of the people in this city, you can fix things, but they might break the next day.
Well, it must make for some pretty good TV. Whose brainchild is this?
The TV station is called Chartia, which means the Eastern One, and it is run by a media tycoon named Saad Bazaz. And most of the employees are former employees of the old information ministry under Saddam Hussein. So there are a lot of people who were out of jobs for maybe a year and a half since the war, but who, you know their job pretty well. A lot of them are Baathists, but a lot of them didn't necessarily subscribe to the politics of the Ba'ath Party. They just happened to be journalists and, worked under this regime. So it's very interesting to see them now becoming part of this independent Iraqi station.
And this station is unlike the other satellite channels available to Iraqis, the Arab language satellite channels, is relatively apolitical, mainly an entertainment channel.
Pretty much. And it's the first channel in the area that has, you know, sort of Iraqi entertainment shows. This is the first Iraqi reality TV show. But the sad thing is, so far, they've only done two houses because it's very expensive. So they're starting to look into advertising deals.
Is the show popular? And what becomes of the people who are fortunate enough to have the crew show up?
They are celebrities, in fact. If you say Hussein, which is the mother of the first family, everyone knows that she was the woman whose house was destroyed and got rebuilt on TV. What the show tries to do is to show not just repairing the house, but they try to show the family evolving as their house is repaired. It's their belief that by repairing the house, they'll also help repair some of the wounds of the war.
Unlike its American counterparts, Labor and Materials ultimately is a show about suffering and loss. Is there any chance that a show like this, which every episode puts really a tiny Band-Aid on a gaping wound, might prove frustrating for Iraqis who are confronted with the reality of violence whenever they step outside? Isn't there something somehow exploitive and awful about turning the horrors of war into redecoration porn?
I don't think so. I mean, I hear what you're saying because I think it's really, really sad to think of the probably close to millions of people who are homeless at this point. But on the other hand, the show is incredibly popular. Every single Iraqi I've ever spoken to about the show loves it because it does show something good and it does show the possibility that somewhere somebody's house is getting repaired. When I went on this shoot, as we were leaving the house, the father of the house said something that I thought was really just very charming and kind of ironic. They were all standing outside, and there was a big plaque outside the house that says, "This house has been rebuilt by Sharkia TV after being destroyed in the war." And he said, "You know, if they destroy my house tonight again, you're going to have to come and rebuild it, and it's going to have to say, 'This house was destroyed by the Americans during the war, and then rebuilt by Sharkia, and then destroyed again, and then rebuilt again.'" And it seemed funny until about 3 minutes later when a bomb tore through the neighborhood. And it just really brought home that, you know, the problems aren't over yet.
Okay. Well, Anya, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Anya Sizadlo is a freelance journalist. She joined us by phone from Baghdad. If an entertainment show from the ruins of war seems counterintuitive, so may the following concept: a website poking fun at the Muslim American experience. Whether through cultural bias or simply the realities of Islam's struggles with itself, we just don't expect to see Muslims cracking jokes about their Muslimness. But then along came Islamica News, an American website that does just that. Mirza Bayed is one of its founders, and he joins me now. Mirza, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you for having me.
I'm looking at a story in the most recent issue, at least as we speak, and it's headlined, "Man Blames Everything on Jews," and it's datelined Israel, Indiana, and it says, "Witnesses stood in awe this morning when a 47-year-old Egyptian man by the name of Habib Yawari lunged into a verbal assault at an area gas station. Quote, 'The damn thing wouldn't take my credit card,' exclaimed Yawari. 'They wanted to make me late. I know it. It's all because of the Jews.'" And it's funny, but there's also sort of an eerie undercurrent to it because of obvious widespread anti-Semitism, especially vocal among Muslim militants. Do you get to a point where the more sensitive the subject matter, the easier it is to be funny, or is there stuff you just stay away from?
There are a lot of areas we simply don't invade. We don't make fun of Islam in any way. We don't make fun of the Prophet in any way, because that goes against our beliefs and our lifestyles. But this article in particular, it focuses on a very important point. I think it's no surprise that the Arab community and the Jewish community have their tensions. And this simply showcases one very elementary facet of that.
What kind of reaction have you gotten from your readers to Islamica News?
It's all over the place. It really depends. If I can just read one of the letters that we got back, it starts out saying, "Assalamu alaikum, peace be upon you. Excuse me, brother, sister, or whatever you are. Have you lost your mind? I mean, do you realize that you are actually making fun of Islam on the website? Are you really Muslim or what?" But at the same time, we get a lot of positive feedback. I got feedback from someone of the Jewish faith that loved the style of Islamica News. It was a huge relief for them to finally see this side of Muslims.
When you get the negative responses from people who question your faith, do you get a little nervous? You know, I'm thinking of Salman Rushdie and the fatwa declared on him after Satanic Verses was published.
Right.
Are you concerned that some imam or ayatollah is going to take it upon himself to declare you an infidel?
I don't think the style of satire is anything new to the Muslim world. If you go in the Middle East, there's much satire in the publications there and the journals there. Salman Rushdie's publication was blasphemy. It was something that the Muslim world looked at as defaming their prophet. With Islamica News, it is nothing. If anything, it aids the Muslim community by addressing issues head on. We can laugh at ourselves by some of the idiotic things that we do, not on a religious level, but just simply on an individual level and a community level.
Here's a headline that seems to me you're running at some risk of making someone angry, and it is, Imam farts but keeps going.
Again, it's nothing as personal with the articles, and it's just one of those quickie things which gets a quick laugh. I don't think we got too elaborate with that at all. We didn't assign any names to it. It's not like it happened in real life. It wasn't anything sacrilege or anything like that. It simply was just one of those funny circumstances that happened to take place at your local mosque.
Well, just the fact that I keep asking you questions about fatwas suggest that I have just bought into all of the nasty stereotypes about Islam. Or is this something that you, as a Muslim humorist, simply have to pay more attention to?
I think it might be a bit of both. And Islamica News kind of breaks that shackle. It breaks that mold. It kind of shows you that face of the Muslim, where the Muslims can be American and they can be funny and they can be Muslim. You know, just in the past few years, we've seen a lot of initiatives among Muslims to kind of fill those non-traditional roles. You've got Muslims in the media, in politics, in government. You've got Muslims in so many other arenas, which you didn't see 10 years ago. I remember the movie True Lies, where Muslims were depicted as terrorists. It was where Arnold Schwarzenegger basically fights all these Arab guys. I don't know if my disappointment came from the fact that these terrorists were Arab and they were being depicted that way, or was it the fact that they had Hispanics playing the roles of Muslims? And now, you know, there are those Muslim actors there, and we can all rest comfortably that those terrorists are being depicted by genuine Arabs and Muslims. So,
thank you know, God that when we're being stereotyped unfairly, it can be with our own people.
At least it's genuine. We kept it real.
Well, Mirza, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mirza Baig is a co-founder of Islamica LP, publishers of Islamica News. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was directed by Katya Rogers and produced by Janine Price, Megan Ryan, and Tony Field, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson our engineer. We had help from Ann Kosseff and Mike Vuolo, and editing help from Sharon Ball. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Arun Roth is our senior producer and Dean Capello our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and get free transcripts and MP3 downloads at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, helping the nation value young people as a resource through research and programs, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable and sustainable society, and the National Endowment for the Arts. Support from the media comes from the Bydell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.